back.
Sightings. Hour number two. I'm Jeff Rentz, and we're talking with Joseph Gill tonight. Joseph on the Big Island in Hawaii. And we got a couple of calls. I want to talk about something slightly different in a few minutes, but let's go to the phones right now and say hello to Roseanne in Portland, listening on KOTK. Hello, Roseanne.
Hi. I have one quick question.
Okay.
Now that we're using, like, plastic cards for money,
mm-hmm.
and our symbols are slowly being robbed from us, how is the best way to retain our equilibrium with the universe?
All right, the better question might be, not better, but how inextricable are these symbols and symbolism, Joe, with our own reference to the universe? Probably extraneous, correct?
Well, it is kind of an interesting question because the Prince of Wales has taken on it upon himself to try and bring more symbolism into the architecture in London.
Mm-hmm.
And in New York, you know, the Avenue of the Americas is just a whole long avenue of big glass boxes without any symbolism. But if you look at the old buildings, you'll see the columns at the front of the enter of the portico, you know, the entrance to the temple of the building, whatever
right.
temple it happens to be. Or you'll see all kinds of symbolism all over it, you know, the Art Nouveau and the Art Deco period.
Oh, gargoyles
right,
everywhere.
Right, that sort of thing. But, you know, we went through a very sterile period in architecture, and I think we're coming out of that now. And I find more interesting architecture. There's an awful lot of Freemasonic architecture, you know, billions of dollars worth of Masonic architecture has gone up in Atlanta and in France and generally all around the world, you know, the obelisk and the pyramid, that
right.
sort of thing.
Can we live without symbols, Joe? And maybe Roseanne's question was more directed to that. Does it matter if we have all these symbols?
Well, yeah, it's us. It's us.
It's our turf, our territory. We marked it and...
Well, no.
It's our backyard.
It's nothing that we own.
It's a reflection of who we are, though.
The message that I have is that our symbols are our environment reflected in our art.
Mm-hmm.
They're picked up in symbols. But firstly, they're in our environment, whether they're the phallus, whether they're the sun, whether they're the backbone or the anatomy of man. But I would like to recommend a book, if I could. And it's called Awaken the World Within. And it talks about a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about tonight in relation to the caduceus. And it's by Hilton Hotema.
Wow.
And I have a toll-free number if people are interested in getting this book. It's 1-888-844-2386. And that is health research, which you probably know about, right?
Hilton Hotema.
Hilton Hotema, Awaken the World Within. And it goes through the seven seals in the Bible and explains how they're the seven chakras and how they follow the caduceus. And basically, it covers... If you like that book, then you get all the rest of them by Hilton Hotema, which, as far as I'm concerned, is probably the most enlightened author in my entire library.
Huh. Okay, and another question, Roseanne?
And probably the most least known.
He's not a household word, that's for sure.
Not at all. And the name of the book to start with is Awaken the World Within, and basically he's a medical doctor, and also he has a great history in religions. And he's quite a scholar, and he goes through the whole scenario. And basically what I am doing and what Hilton Hotema would do for you is build a general foundation that so when you're walking along the road and you see something, say, wow, that's where that's from,
mm-hmm.
where that's from.
That's fun,
yeah, because
if nothing else.
You know about your roots.
Sure.
It's like studying what they call geomorphology is when you study the earth and how it's shaped by environmental forces like by wind and water, and you can look at a mountain and know why it's shaped that way because there was a glacier came down or because it's a volcano or, you know, we look at our environment with the basic knowledge of rudimentary symbolism and we can understand that, this religion is just basically reflecting symbols and adapting a story to it to suit their purpose.
All right. Thank you, Roseanne.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
It would be nice. It would seem that this kind of thing would be taught as
a
routine.
It is the language before the so-called Tower of Babel.
Yeah, sure.
And if they took, I don't think they could take symbolism away. Because if you did take away all the symbols in the environment, you would still have the sun. You would still have the phallus. You would still have.
It would almost be reinvented, wouldn't it?
It would just be more. It'll be a little harder to figure out.
And then we'd reinvent it.
Certainly. If you go to more basic countries like India, where their symbolism is a lot more understandable than ours, and then you come back to ours, it's just easy. It's really easy. And I sat down with a teacher of the Dalai Lama, which, incidentally, his name means Lamb of God, and Dalai Lama. I met with the Dalai Lama several times. I used to be a guest lecturer at Harvard on numerous occasions, and also IU was a director of Sotheby's in New York, the biggest auction house in the world.
Right.
And we had offices all over the world when I worked with them. So that's some of my background.
Well, that was
being an author, and I've published over 100 works. So.
Fascinating to have been with Sotheby's to see all the remarkable icons of our past come through that venue, I would imagine. Just amazing.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've personally sold Renoirs, Picassos, Monets. I sold Liz Taylor's pear-shaped diamond. I've sold pieces to the Shah of Iran. I would like to mention a little warning to Mark, the caller from Philadelphia, is that, I think that Zachariah Sitchin has an awful lot to offer, but I wouldn't recommend becoming a Zachariah Sitchinite. In other words, don't turn it into a religion. Discover the possibilities. And whatever we got from Nibiru, they got from nature. And so ultimately, whatever culture that you study, no matter how old or how evolved they are, all that they have is from nature. And as a matter of fact, being an art expert myself, I used to sell over $65 million worth of art every year. I would say that the best art is that which duplicates nature closest, and that's the most endearing, long-lasting art. You look at any of the old masters, that's what you see.
Representational.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's head to Spokane, and Bill's been patiently waiting. Hello, Bill, listening on KSBN, as always up there in the great city. Hello, and welcome, and your question.
Good evening, Jeff. Good evening, sir. About this caduceus, I certainly don't have the worldly experience of your guest, but I've noticed a couple things about it. I have some geometric tiles that they form regular polyhedra. And when I take the triangular ones with the edge length the same and put them all together, and I use the various colors, I alternate them in a specific pattern, it comes out in the double helix structure, okay, with all the colors separated on their sides. And there's something going on with the 60-degree geometry that Buckminster Fuller talked about.
Right.
And, you know, he's used that for several discoveries before science got around to it, like the buckyballs and the fullerenes and all that. You know, it's not just the symbol. There's actually a relationship to the way things are in creation. What you call nature, I'll call creation.
It's the same Bible thing.
And I see many of these symbols and structures in the Bible, but I want to assert one thing very carefully. The Bible is just not another religious text, and it maintains its own distinctness, because like when Moses appeared before Pharaoh, he cast down the rod and the magicians did that and they turned into serpents, but Moses' rod ate up their rod. So
right. Well, basically, you know, you won't like what I've got to say, but basically Moses' rod is nothing more than his phallus. And Moses going across the Sea of Reeds is a story that's repeated from when the Jewish people were in Babylon 1,500 years before Jesus was supposed to have ever been born. Before Moses was ever to be born, there's a story of a child that was put in a small little boat and floated down and was pulled out of the river by royalty. And that royalty was the Queen of Babylon, which was some 1,500 years before the story that Moses was supposed to have. So basically, when they dug up the tablets of Nineveh, which were some 60,000 stone tablets in a civilization that pre-existed Moses by at least 1,800 years, they found the stories that were evolved in the Bible, each and every one of them, but each of the stories were like six times longer. And those stories were abbreviated and put into a group of stories called the Bible. But this isn't something you have to take my word for it. You just study the tablets of Nineveh, which is in Iran, and you can get those, some of those on the internet. You can find that many different stories that are in the Bible pre-existed in the tablets of Nineveh in a much, much longer form.
Hello?
Go ahead, Bill.
In studying Bucky's Fuller's work, I see that he has static figures and dynamic ones.
Okay, Bill, hold on right there. Please, we want to get to that point and let you make it fully without having to stop, which we do now just for a couple of minutes to say hello to our sponsors who make all of this possible. Be right back. We're back, and Bill is on the line from Spokane. Hello, Bill. Go ahead and make your point now, please.
In Bucky's geometry, he had a figure called a vector equilibrium, which is also called a cube octahedron. It's very floppy, but the unique thing about this one is it relates the five regular polyhedra of, you know, Plato or Platonic solids, they're called. And those are static states, and this is dynamic. When Moses stood before Pharaoh, he took a rod. And as you said, I'm not shocked at all by what you said. I take it in stride. He put it down on the ground, and that thing started turning into a dynamic thing where it had been a static thing. And the magicians knew how to do that same thing, but there was a difference. The math that Bucky describes all creation is based on is divided by the number 3 and 6. Moses knew the Hebrew letter 7, which means a covenant and an oath with God. And that's why his word stood, and all the magicians' words were defeated. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Bill.
And, well, that's excellent. And basically, you know, he's just talking symbolism. And as I said before, symbolism is reflected in our art. And one of our art forms is architecture as well as painting. So all forms of art reflect nature. And nature is, you know, is the language of nature is numbers. So he's absolutely right. Buckminster Fuller was a magician of architecture.
It's always fascinating also to look back at art through the last 1,000 years and watch how it reflects the society in which it was created, and music as well. Music,
well, we
architecture,
came to a great
furniture.
Dark period, and that was when the buildings were all smooth without any symbolism in them. And I think that symbolism, be it Freemasonic or the different religions that take to it, be it Freemasonic or Catholic or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist, are really the symbols of nature. And the closer that they can get to nature, the more followers that they'll get to come to their church.
Always
that. I mean, it's so simple.
Yes.
You look at the end of any, you know, big church, you see a sun there with a clock in the wheel window, and you'll see the 12 signs of the apostles, or you'll see the 12 signs of the zodiac. They have it right up there to show it to you. It's not even, you know, if you look at it with an open mind, it's really easy to figure
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm. 1-888 on radio is our phone number if you'd like to call in and talk to Joe Gill about symbolism. What was I going to say? Oh, yes, architecture. Always interesting to look at the homes of the rich and sometimes famous. These people have the ability to express themselves architecturally and reflect the society and their own personal tastes and fetishes, if you will. Remarkable survey of our contemporary world can be gained by looking at some of the homes of the very wealthy around the world and how they appoint them. It's very indicative
well,
of our times.
I was going to be an architect at one time, and my one stab at architecture, in fact, Frank Lloyd Wright's wife called me up from their special school down in Arizona, and instead of that, I went to Colorado School of Mines. But I built my house here very metaphysically. It's four stories high, and it's right in the center of the property. I have one of the largest libraries in the world on metaphysics, and it's basically devoted to self-sufficiency. I have some 65 different kinds of fruit trees, and every day of the year is beautiful weather. And so if any of your listeners out there want to start a metaphysical center or know anybody that's interested in starting a full-fledged metaphysical center or a getaway retreat, my place is up for sale along with the library, because I'm moving on. I've got what I needed out of my studies over the last 25 or 30 years, and basically I'm moving on to new avenues.
A lot of these books came through your contacts at Sotheby's, didn't they?
No.
They did not?
Not at all.
How did you acquire such an amazing library?
Well, I'm a bibliophile. I started out by writing. I got an international directory of book dealers around the world, and I wrote 25 letters a day, 7 days a week, for 5 years, handwritten. And people were writing me from Scotland or Germany, saying, please don't send me any more want lists. I know what you want. I inundated the world with my want list at a time when books were a lot less expensive. And so basically right now I have nothing on my want list, and people are always wanting me to submit my original books so that they can be put up for reprint. And I've offered 30 of my books, extremely rare, from the 1700s to 1600s, up for reprint, and I think that's good to get that knowledge out there. I don't hoard them for myself, but I do hold them in high esteem.
Would your book library be available by itself? Say an institution wanted to acquire it?
Well, right now I'm interested in selling my house as a metaphysical center with a library, and if that doesn't work out, of course, that's the alternative, selling the library separately. But if you're interested, you can go to www.lavazone2.com/JGILL and see a full description and also about 20 pictures of the house and the library and a listing of the authors in the library, some of the authors. And basically, it is, as you said in the beginning, an attempt in architecture to become one with nature. My house is a pole house, and so it's made out of telephone poles. And it's 88 feet by 58 feet, and it's 44 feet high. It's huge.
I don't hear any 7s or 33s in there.
No.
All right,
but it is at one with the forest, you know.
Yes.
There's trees all around. It's in natural forest all around the house, and I overlook the ocean. So.
All right. Coming up on the break here, Sunday night for you, Tim Rifat, R-I-F-A-T, from England, one of the world's most interesting authorities outside of the military on remote viewing. Tim, just much to say about many things. When we come back, we'll continue on here with Joseph Gill. 1-888 on radio. We're going to talk about Antarctica and the Larsen Ice Shelf, among other things, next for you here tonight. Okay, we're back with Joseph Gill, and we're going to talk about something a little bit different now. We have been seeing much on the net lately about and in the mainstream media to some degree, about the Larsen Ice Shelf and the difficulties apparently popping up all over Antarctica. It is warming up down there, and the Larsen Ice Shelf, which acts, as Joseph said, much in the way of a large buttress holding up this, what is it, 4 miles thick? I don't know, the ice on Antarctica. Well, let me ask Joseph to give us his view on that. Go ahead.
Well, basically, I'm a geologist, and I worked for the USGS for a while and was a full-fledged geologist then, turned gemologist. It's a little cleaner sport.
Well, it starts with the same letter, so I understand.
That aside, My heart is in geology, and when they started talking about El Nino and man's effect on the environment, I thought, what a lot of bunk, because Tenatubo, I think, in Philippines.
Tenatubo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, threw out more pollution in its one eruption than we have in the entire Industrial Revolution. And so what I did...
That's a very important perspective to keep in mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Mount St. Helens went up, it was bigger than probably all the atomic bombs that have been tested on the surface, as far as the energy mm-hmm. that was released.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, nature's power dwarfs ours, including our nuclear weapons. You know, I started looking at the sun, and I noticed that we've got a special project over here on Maui, one of the observatories. You can find it on the web, the SOLO project, and every day they put up pictures of the sun. In the last 3 years, the sun has been going crazy. So what happens is when the sun has a lot of these storms and magnetic anomalies that it throws off, it shifts around large masses of metal inside of the earth, you know, the big iron deposits, the heavy metal deposits on towards the inner part of the earth.
And a lot of these are magma. Yeah,
and as that moves around, it causes volcanoes. That's what causes volcanoes, is the shifts in the mass of the crust of the earth. And it really is all within the first 300 miles deep. Of course, you know, the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter. So the first 300 miles is where most of the volcanoes come from.
Well, the Earth's crust is an average of only 30 miles thick.
Yeah, it's about 27 miles thick. And so what's happening is that it starts heating this little onion skin layer of ocean on it. And so some areas of the Antarctic were heated up over 20 to 25 degrees higher than usual. And then, of course, you have the Larsen Ice Shelf and the Ross Ice Shelf,
mm-hmm.
Breaking off. And the Ross Ice Shelf is about the same size as France. And Antarctica is actually larger than continental Europe. It's about the same size as the United States and a third of Canada. It's 10% of all the land mass in the world is in Antarctica. And 95% of all of the ice that's in the entire world is in Antarctica. So you have
95%.
95% of all the ice in all the world is in one continent, that's Antarctica.
Wow.
So the shelves around it will break off. Now, of course, they won't add anything, maybe a foot or two, to the level of the ocean, because they're already in the ocean. But across this big pimple that's sticking up called Antarctica, this big rock structure that has been smoothed off by all this glaciation that's happened over the last millenniums, it's all out of the water, and it's about 20,000 foot thick on the average, 30,000 foot thick.
4 to 5 miles.
Yeah, it's about 4 to 4.5 miles thick, and that's over an area the size of the United States and a third of Canada. Now, when the buttressing breaks off, what's going to happen? Well, I was listening to NOVA about 8 months ago, and the last place I'd look for information. But anyway, they were talking about how they were noticing that the ice was moving faster. These huge complexes of glaciers that are moving down Antarctica slopes were moving faster. So they drilled a hole down 4 miles deep down to the edge of the base rock,
mm-hmm.
and they found there's a layer of warm, slippery mud underneath all of the glaciers in Antarctica. So, you know, this isn't something that I've channeled or, you know, saw it from the spirit or anything like that. It's just physically there. You can see how the ice shelf is breaking off around Antarctica. You've got a volcano under Antarctica, and you've got the glaciers speeding up towards the edge of Antarctica, and we have a raised beach shelf here on Maui that's 1,100 feet high. And in numbers of places along the edge of the Rockies, you'll find that there are raised beach shelves where they would be caused by giant waves coming in and pushing up detritus or refuge rock and that sort of thing, and it's piled up along the edge at the height of where the wave hit the mountains.
As in tidal wave.
Right. So I've been talking about this for about a year on the internet, and my fiance just came back from Fiji, and she told me that 60 Minutes, sort of a sister group of 60 Minutes, ran a show on exactly what I'm talking about and how three-quarters of Fiji would be underwater. So basically, this is, if you want something to be scared about, this is something to be scared about, because about 80% of the world's population is under 400 feet, and if you study glaciation and geology, you'll see that between major changes in ice building and ice breaking down, there's a level difference in the ocean of 400 to 600 feet. So when you've got a 20,000 to 25,000 foot mass of ice as big as the whole United States and a third of Canada all of a sudden breaking off into the ocean,
even if it
broke off a little piece at a time, but you know, not enough to cause these big waves,
mm-hmm.
The bottom line would be the sea level would raise 400 to 600 feet. That's a 40-story building to a 60-story building high, and that would fill up the Great Valley in California. It would get rid of all the seacoast cities of the world. You have to think like a world. You know, it's not just the United States. So basically, a lot of the world's land mass would be covered with water. And
apparently has been in the past.
Right. And, of course, then the whole structure of the Earth would change as far as its climate goes. And you'd have tropical forest. They have fossils, tropical forest in Antarctica that they found.
Really amazing. Be right back with Joseph Gill as we continue getting some email questions. If you want to call in, you're welcome to 1-888-ON-RADIO. The call is on us, of course. My email address, EOTL, stands for end of the line at west.net. As we roll along with Joseph Gill on the phone live, our guest tonight from Hawaii. Let's go to Santa Barbara and Elliot on a cell phone listening to this program on AM 990 KTMS. Hello, Elliot. Your question.
Yeah, I'm a little out of sequence here, but I wanted to ask you about the symbolism of the Star of David, or sometimes known as the Key of Knowledge.
Sure.
Star of David,
yeah,
inscribed in a circle.
That's an excellent question. Actually, if you'll travel India, you'll find that the so-called Star of David is much, much, much older than that. And basically, it's the pyramid going up and the pyramid going down. And the pyramid going up, fire is one of the elements. And when fire burns, it burns like a pyramid going up. The tongue goes up, right?
Right.
And water, which is symbolic of the spirit, when it falls down like a drop, it comes down like a pyramid coming down. So it's purely a union of fire and water. And
balance again.
Right. And in the center is represented a dot, like you'll see on the dollar bill.
So it's really the, 7 points.
You'll see the dot is the germ or
point of origin.
Or the, you know, it's recreation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's what that comes from. So that's the Star of David is much older than is depicted in that culture. It goes far back, and it is one of those basic old symbols. Another symbol. Pardon me.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you'd have any of acquainted with Claude Bragdon's books on.
Oh yeah, I have all of his books.
Yeah,
excellent. In fact, he was another great architect. You know, he was the one that brought over Ouspensky and Gurdjieff.
Right. And my father was a friend of Claude Bragdon's.
Right, right. Well, he'd be a good friend to have. He'd be an interesting guy. I've read all of his books, and his books are now available, all of them, in reprint.
Oh, great.
Claude Bragdon. So you can just go into any bookstore and dial up Claude Bragdon and get really every one of his books now, several of which I supplied from my personal library for reprint, and that's the reason why they are in reprint.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank
Elliot.
You.
Thanks for
Bye-bye.
The call.
Wanted to kind of go off on sort of a tangent here, if you wouldn't mind, about college graduation.
It's September. Well, not quite a
sink.
Yeah,
it's a little late, but, you know, when we graduate in a college or in a high school even, what do we have? We have a square palette on our roof, on our top. We gown and cap.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we graduate, the cap is with the four sides is represented. When you watch a stonemason will hold up a pallet with a peg on the bottom, four sides. Then he'll take a three-sided trowel,
mm-hmm.
and he'll take cement, and he'll put it between the blocks of stone or concrete blocks and build a wall. So when you graduate, you graduate Bachelor of Science, Master's, and then you get your PhD. And when you're in Freemasonry, you're an entering apprentice, fellowship mason, and master mason. And the black robe is the robe of Saturn. So basically what they're telling you when you wear that robe is you are carrying a pile of cement on top of this square cap.
Uh-huh.
And you are about ready to enter into this wall of civilization. And you have been properly squared off, polished, and ready to enter into what we call civilization or society. And that is represented by a wall, because civilizations, they make walls.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's architecture, and so we fit into that architecture by that way. Similarly, the Egyptians used to carve their gods as cubes, and they were just a simple cube, and out of the top of the cube was a head. And if you'll go to the Cairo Museum, you'll see several of those cubes with a head coming out, and those are the different gods. And we have now I'm not a Freemason, okay? I'm not a member of any religious group, but I study them. So when you study Freemasonry, you learn about what's called the unfolded man. Now, a unfolded man, when you go in as an entering apprentice, you are considered an ashtar or an unpolished stone. You're like right from the quarry where they've just sort of cut you out of solid rock,
mm-hmm.
and your edges need to be polished, and you need to be squared off.
Diamond in the rough.
You need to be fit into this wall.
Right.
And so as you go from entering apprentice to fellowship mason to master mason, then you also get polished off, and you unfold. Now, a cube has six sides, so just pretend like you've got yourself a cardboard box, and you fold out four sides, that's four sides up, and then the two ends out. And so it's four up, three across. And four up and three across is seven. And the center is your heart. You know, that's the unfolded man.
Hmm.
And that's basically what we are when we graduate and we enter into the wall of society. And it's very, very symbolic of a wall because walls don't move. You join the wall and you become part of it or you fall out of it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah, so it's part of our culture. I mean, basically, the Freemasons were the Templars, and the Templars were people that were wealthy that went to fight in the Crusades, and they were the only ones that could afford to, the wealthy people, because the rest had to work in the feudalism, the fields.
I would have picked the fields myself. But.
Yeah, well, you know, it's adventure.
It was
exciting,
sport.
Going off to the Holy Land.
Big time sport, yes.
Right. And then when they came back, they became Muslims. and they followed what was called Baphomet, which is the god of the Muslims, which is the goat-headed god, which we symbolize with Lucifer, and they worship the crescent moon and the star, which is really Venus, which is the home of Lucifer. And that's what you see on Muslim flags. You see the crescent and the star. And you'll see in Mecca that big, huge Kaaba.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
The big cube
big
in
cube.
Mecca that's
yep.
made out of meteorite. And the head of the Mecca, the head of their religion, goes inside of that every year and washes his feet in ceremony. And I have some outstanding pictures of that in my library. But basically, that's the cube again. And the
yeah.
cube is also symbolic of the earth. And so we have to think of these symbols not as two-dimension, but three-dimension.
We had a really interesting geometry right from the very beginning, the pyramid,
right.
the triangle, the cube, the circle, the sphere, all their
questions. Well, the cube is the earth, and on
mm-hmm.
top of the cube sits the ball, and that's the pearl of the ocean, so that's symbolic of water. And on top of that is a triangle with a point going up, and that's representative of fire because the fire always goes up. And on top of that is a crescent sitting on its back, and that is air. And on top of that is it like a teardrop coming down, and that's ether. And that's the gray matter that the astronomers have just recently found that constitutes some 90% of the mass of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I had Jerry Nelson, who was the inventor of the Keck telescope, the largest telescope in the world.
The Keck Observatory?
Yeah, mm-hmm. here on the island down at the house, and I was explaining to him about ether and dark matter, and he didn't like that at all, but that's the truth. So the metaphysicians, basically astronomy used to be called astrology, alchemy used to be called, or chemistry used to be called alchemy, and all these old-time religions like alchemy or astrology all civilized themselves and changed their names, and they went through a long period.
Yeah, right.
No willingness to admit their past.
No, we have no past except pure empirical science.
Right.
We were immaculately created. No skeletons in our closet. We have about a minute left or so. We have a number of questions piling up. You mentioned, Joseph, that all the texts go back to a more remote past. Can you talk about that? At what point does the information begin? Where do you think we came from? You've got about a minute and a half to answer that one.
Well, I think I answered that in a previous show that
you did.
We are planted here.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're going to tell you that there was some mass of cloud going through the cosmos that littered its little double helixes all over the different planets and the different solar systems. And then we evolved through Darwinian evolution, and that's a lot of bunk.
Well, you need to read that paper on Darwinism on
the
website.
No, I've already read that, yeah. And basically, there's never, ever in our known history ever been one species that's turned into another. There are over 100 million forms of different species on the face of the Earth right now by biological count. And of those 100 million, we don't have one single example of one species turning into another. And any dog breeder or horse breeder will tell you that you can only go so far in breeding, and then the outcome becomes infertile. So I believe, like Charles Fort, that we were planted here in total, and we've gone through cycles of civilization and self-ruin, and anybody can look around today and see we're heading towards self-ruin. We're overpopulated. We've got all these problems that are accumulating, and people are going into mass hysteria over the year 2000.
Well,
basically,
yes.
Let's remember our origins and settle down and try and be part of nature.
Good
Thank
words.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. Well, you'll be back after the top of the hour. We'll continue. We're getting questions on the idea of the seas rising. From a geological perspective, what you're saying makes sense. We'll talk about...
You have a great audience.
They are so respectful and so intelligent. No matter what their views, they have always extraordinary questions.
I've been amazed.
Yes, yes. We'll be right back with Joseph Gill, and our phone number here again, we have a couple lines open, is 1-888-ON-RADIO, and we shall continue.